This is The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. Last night, President Obama delivered his State of the Union address, his first since Republicans took over the House of Representatives and made major gains in the Senate. We'll have reaction from two political science professors in Iowa, Donna Hoffman from the University of Northern Iowa and Tim Hagel from the University of Iowa. They'll talk about the address, the Republican response, and the impact on Iowa and Iowans. Also on the show, we'll talk about Iowa's new and open process to select Supreme Court justices, and Minnesota Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann was in Iowa and could be another candidate for president. We'll also have your comments via email, Twitter, Facebook, and the phone. That's coming up on The Exchange right after this check of news from NPR. This is The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull, in for Ben Kiefer. It's Politics Day. Last night was the State of the Union address, so we'll be talking a lot about that and a couple of other topics with our guests this week. Donna Hoffman, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa, joins us from our Cedar Falls studios. Good afternoon, Donna. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
And from the University of Iowa's Political Science Department in our Iowa City studios, Tim Hagel. Tim, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Let's start by playing a little bit of tape from last night's State of the Union speech. The president sought to lay out a vision for the country, a lot more big picture rather than a detail-oriented speech. And part of that vision, he asked Americans to recall the space race and its impact on the country 50 years ago.
A half a century ago, when the Soviets beat us into space with the launch of a satellite called Sputnik, we had no idea how we would beat them to the moon. The science wasn't even there yet. NASA didn't exist. But after investing in better research and education, we didn't just surpass the Soviets. We unleashed a wave of innovation that created new industries and millions of new jobs. This is our generation's Sputnik moment.
President Obama from last night's State of the Union address. Oftentimes, State of the Union addresses wind up being a laundry list, and people say they want more details. But, Donna, we'll start with you. Did you think this big picture strategy was effective last night?
I think it was pretty effective. Obama obviously is a good orator, so he gives a good speech. As you mentioned, the speech was a little more thematic than maybe some of the other speeches that we've had in the past. But, you know, that if you look at how Obama has done things previously, like how he laid out health care reform, for example, he did kind of go the big picture out and let Congress work out the details. And so this really kind of is in keeping with the way he approaches his relationship with Congress, I would say, by laying out a big picture, doing the big theme, big ideas, and the details, you know, are left a little bit more to Congress.
Do you think it was inspiring? And if so, Are these addresses more to be inspiring to the American people or inspiring to the Congress to pass the president's agenda?
Well, a little bit of both. I mean, I do think the speech was inspiring. I think it got more inspiring there at the end when he started his conclusion. But the people who the president is addressing directly in the room obviously are members of Congress. But he's also got the public audience in mind when he addresses this. And one of the things that we know is that presidents oftentimes will try to speak to the public to get them to support their ideas, their issues, in an attempt that the public will rally behind them and put pressure on Congress to do something. Now, that usually isn't really all that successful, but presidents still do quite a bit of it.
Tim, what was your take on the speech last night?
Well, I would agree that Obama's a good orator, but I didn't think that he really reached the levels that he needed to have a really successful speech. This is pretty much a middle-of-the-road kind of a speech. It did have a laundry list of items, a little of this, a little of that. He tried to go for the big theme, but I thought ultimately it fell fairly flat. By the time he got to that, the line towards the end, "We do big things, we do big things," you know, people were already tired of all these little things that he was mentioning, that the little things didn't add up to the big things, this, that, and another thing. And as far as the Sputnik moment goes, well, that was kind of nice, except for the fact that he's cutting the funding for the space program. So if you're going to use a space analogy, that's probably the wrong time to use it. So, you know, critics, of course, are not going to like what he has to say in terms of the policy stuff. And so they were pretty quick to start picking it apart, and especially the big things line, where I saw some people almost immediately, some of the wittier folks would say, yeah, we do big things, big government, big spending, and big debt. And so he really didn't address the core problem, which is how do we deal with the debt and the deficit?
Well, he did do one somewhat specific thing. He, and we'll listen to a little more of the address, the president sought to present himself as more moderate. He talked about some areas of agreement between Republicans and Democrats. He talked about deficit reduction. He also called for a five-year freeze of domestic spending and even tax cuts.
Over the years, a parade of lobbyists has rigged the tax code to benefit particular companies and industries. Those with accountants or lawyers to work the system can end up paying no taxes at all. But all the rest are hit with one of the highest corporate tax rates in the world. It makes no sense, and it has to change. So tonight I'm asking Democrats and Republicans to simplify the system. Get rid of the loopholes. Level the playing field. And use the savings to lower the corporate tax rate for the first time in 25 years without adding to our deficit. It can be done.
So, Tim, do you think the speech was bipartisan enough, especially considering some of those overt overtures to Republicans right in their sweet spot?
Well, certainly the clip that you played is regarding the corporate tax, that's certainly made conservatives fairly happy. You talk about the loopholes and things, and certainly there's going to be an evening out there, and he talks about it, so that's deficit neutral. And that's true. If you lower the tax and get rid of the loopholes, that you're sort of, you know, evening things out. And so by and large, people are pleased with that, and especially as we're getting into tax season now and people are having to do their taxes, they would like to have a more simplified process. But on the other hand, I saw one Democratic strategist talking about this and say, well, you know, you have to keep in mind that one person's loophole is another person's incentive to invest in something, whether it's green technology or, you know, whatever else it happens to be. So you kind of have to keep that in mind, too, as to all these loopholes weren't there just, you know, to benefit evil corporations or something like that. That often it was a way to encourage people to put their money, private money, into certain areas.
Donna Hoffman, since President Obama has tried to move more towards the center in recent months, or really maybe even through his entire administration so far, he's criticized from the right from being too liberal, and the liberal base has concerns about him moving too much towards the right. In that context, how do you think he did last night in trying to allay the fears of both of those sets of critics?
Well, you know, he's in a difficult position, and I think he did decently in trying to, you know, carve a middle road and not overtly push some of the buttons of the people in the wings that he's had some issues with. But, you know, governing is a messy business. I mean, he even talked about, you know, our democracy is messy. And given that he's got a House of Representatives now controlled by the Republicans, they have to govern. They have to at least be able to do some of the things that have to get done. And so he's got to work with Republicans. He's in a similar position as Clinton was in after the 94 elections. And, you know, Clinton got criticized for being too moderate from his wing as well. But they were able to get some things done. And at the end of the day, the public is going to hold Obama responsible because he's president. Were you able to get anything done? And so while you know, the Republicans collectively control the House of Representatives, Obama really has to show that he can do some things, especially as he's leading into election of 2012, that they can get something accomplished. And so it's really in his best interest and in the long run, the interest of the Democratic Party that they actually sit down and try to work on some things. And, you know, the tax code simplification, which would include, you know, potentially the corporate tax that you mentioned that you played for the clip from, are things that at least potentially the Democrats and the Republicans can sit down at a table and agree on some things.
We'd love to hear from you as well. If you have a comment or a question, you can call us at 866-780-9100. You can also send us an email at theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. You can also send us a tweet at IPR Talk. And we do have a tweet. Susan in Iowa criticizes the president for no mention in the speech of the mortgage crisis, climate change, leadership in general. Is the president conscious of these serious problems? Donna.
Oh, I think he is. Now, you have to recognize that there's only so much space in a State of the Union address, and there are just tons of people competing to get a mention of their project, their proposal. And Clinton used to try to get everybody in. His speeches would go to 90 minutes sometimes or close to it. So Obama's was right at an hour, and you've got to prioritize and you've got to decide what gets in and what doesn't get in. And I don't think – and I think he ignored some things that weren't mentioned, like the person that you read from suggested, that might have been the more contentious issues, the more hot-button issues. And that really didn't seem to fit in the way I think of the speech that he delivered last night with this kind of above the – I mean, he was trying to be above the fray, trying to go for big themes. And so it was conscious decision. I'm sure that they've got to leave some things out. And if we're going to try to strike a note of civility and working together and advancing the country because we're all Americans, then some of those things, while they might still be important, simply didn't get a mention in this particular address.
Do you think that's because those topics might be ones that there is very little opportunity for bipartisan compromise on, and that not worth the president's time in what is a limited window to try to put things out there that a Republican-controlled House would pass and a Democratic-controlled Senate would approve and get to him to sign?
Right. And they're some of the more contentious issues. And, and again, Obama needs to – I mean, he's got to recognize he's limited. You know, one of the problems with State of the Union addresses in the way they're delivered is that we focus on the president and he says, I want to do X. And we think, oh, well, he's the president. Of course he can get that done. But he has to have Congress to go along with him. And he realizes that. And he's gearing up for a reelection campaign in 2012. And so he's going to be conscious of what is doable, what he wants to talk about. And simply because he didn't mention them in the State of the Union address doesn't necessarily mean they're not on the agenda. Doesn't necessarily mean that, in fact, to get some of those things accomplished, a private strategy with negotiation, bargaining with members of Congress might actually be more effective than putting a public spotlight on it.
Tim, how effective do you think State of the Union addresses ever are with Congress? I mean, are there really members of Congress that walk out of the chamber that night and think, wow, I'd never thought of it that way. I think I will work with this president.
Well, probably not. I mean, obviously, these are folks in Congress that are well-versed in the issues, and so they have a pretty good idea.
Even with the very large freshman class, I guess I'd amend that question with that.
No, even with a large freshman class. I mean, these folks, they may be new to Congress, but, they were on the campaign trail, and many of them were running against incumbents, and so they had to be prepared on the issues. I mean, it's pretty rare that anybody that was a complete neophyte is going to get elected and has no clue as far as what the issues are. Now, what they're probably looking for is to see areas where they can, in fact, work, if we're talking about, especially since it's a large Republican freshman class, looking for areas where they can work and find some common ground with the president. So that's where he has to sort of reach out to the other side a little bit, saying, yes, I am willing to work with you. And he did some of that on health care. I don't think that in terms of the things that were left out of the speech, that it was necessarily a good thing or necessarily because they were contentious. I'm not sure what's particularly contentious about the mortgage crisis. And that really is something that's on the table for a lot of people. And so it probably should have been something that he mentioned. Climate change, okay, maybe that's going to be a little bit more of a problem, especially since he wants to maybe avoid the whole cap and trade stuff and all the problems that opens up. But on the other hand, some of these things that are clearly problems that are facing the nation right now, I mean, well, that's the point of this particular speech. What's the State of the Union? What are problems that we're facing right now? And so certainly he had to talk about bipartisanship and working together, given that the Republicans had taken over the House. But there's a lot more there, and it's particularly in terms of, okay, he made a few mentions about entitlements, and we've got to do something about this. But in terms of any kind of specifics, he pretty much avoided them. And that's some of the stuff that really he needed to talk about. And in fact, that's what the Republican response was all about. And that was one of the things, even though it was much shorter, it focused in right on the particular issue, the heart of all of this. in a way that Obama didn't. Okay, with Obama, of course, it's a State of the Union. He's the leader of the country, and so he's trying to cover a wider range of things. But the core problem that's facing the nation right now is this mounting debt that we've got and how to deal with it and how to reduce the deficit.
Deficit reduction, that's obviously one of the big topics. And since the State of the Union address last night, the Congressional Budget Office released an upgraded estimate of this year's deficit, taking into account the tax cuts that were extended at the end of last year. The new estimate is $1.5 trillion in deficit spending this year. And even though the president talked about the deficit, he also talked extensively about investments the country needed to make. Let's listen.
Cutting the deficit by gutting our investments in innovation and education is like lightening an overloaded airplane by removing its engine. It may make you feel like you're flying high at first, but it won't take long before you feel the impact.
Donna, conservatives immediately after the speech said that the president's continued reference to investment is just another word to say more government spending. Do you think that came off to the average American that might have heard that?
I mean, yeah, I think to some degree. But, you know, Obama clearly is taking the approach that was something that I think might, in fact, resonate with Americans, especially when he was talking about education and infrastructure. You know, with high-profile incidences in the past years of bridge failings and that kind of thing. Those are things that Americans come into contact with, you know, daily. Or, I mean, not necessarily a failing bridge, but, you know, various issues of infrastructure, problems with education funding. And I think he was trying to point out to Americans that investment can also be an avenue to spurring innovation. You know, why did he use the Sputnik example in his speech? Because Sputnik sparked investment in education. And then he went on to mention, you know, this other kinds of technologies, other kinds of industry that shot off from that. So he was trying to convey that to the American public. And I think I think that is something that will resonate with them to some degree. But the larger point remains that I think the public also understands, it's pretty clear given, you know, the rise of the Tea Party, that you can't just spend and spend, and there do need to be some cuts made. What those cuts are is where Obama really is getting the most criticism, I think, from this particular speech and certainly from Republicans, is being more specific about what is not necessary spending, what can be cut. And that, quite frankly, is going to be very, very difficult in talking about, you know, the things that he wanted to freeze the spending on. He very clearly mentioned, look, this is 12% of the federal budget. We got to do some other things. And that's where he wasn't very specific. And that's where, you know, Congress is really going to hammer this out. And Obama's approach to Congress is different, I think, than what we've seen some recent presidents, in that he is a little more open to letting them work out some of the details. He's also – that opens him up to subject – or excuse me, to criticism of the fact that he's not leading. And that's a line that he has to walk. He got that criticism with the health care reform debate as well.
Well, and with now the House in Republican control and the Senate in Democrat control, is that a recipe for gridlock?
It doesn't have to be. Certainly it can be. And that's where a point in which presidential leadership can be very important. But again, they do have to govern, and there are things that they have to do. And so it will be interesting to see how Obama handles that situation, because obviously it's one that's new to him as president. But, you know, divided government is more common historically in the last 50 years than unified government. And things do get done. Even big things get done. It's a lot more difficult to do them. And that's where presidential leadership can be very important. And so there you might see a lot more behind the scenes things that Obama and people in his administration will be doing, and using members of Congress and relationships between the two chambers and longstanding members of Congress to perhaps work out some of those differences, some problems, and to get some compromise.
You're listening to The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. Donna Hoffman from the University of Northern Iowa and Tim Hagel from the University of Iowa are our guests. What was your favorite part of the speech? Do you have a least favorite part of the speech? Do you think it was flat, or was it inspiring? Do you think there's a Sputnik moment? You can let us know by calling 866-780-9100. 866-780-9100. You can send us an email at theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. You can also send us a tweet on Twitter at IPR Talk. Tim, do you think there really is going to be any common ground where Republicans and Democrats can look at this budget and make significant spending cuts that will actually mean a dent in this $1.5 trillion deficit?
Well, that's the $1.5 trillion question, isn't it? You know, I think that there are some areas where they can at least make starts. And sometimes you hear people say, oh, well, we can cut this program. And somebody else will say, oh, but that's only $50 million, only $50 million. And they say, oh, well, it's, you know, it's a drop in the bucket. But, you know, those drops in the bucket add up. And that means that you've got to start getting in that mindset where there are things that we think are good things, good programs, government programs. You don't have to just cut the bad programs. Sometimes even good programs may have to come on the chopping block because we just can't afford it right now. And so when you talk about or when Obama talks about investing, which is spending, as most people will understand it, that you say, okay, this is a good thing, but can we or do we want to go into debt, further debt, to pay for this? Is it worth it in that sense? And that's a harder question. And so if you start making those little cuts here and there and start refocusing and saying, well, what are the things we really need to do as opposed to just the things we want to do? And if you can get into that mindset, then maybe you can start down that road where, in fact, you're going to start solving that deficit problem and maybe someday even start working on the debt.
Is that a seemingly impossible task, considering that for every one of those, even the little things, there's a huge constituency that doesn't want to see it cut. There's lobbyists that don't want to see it cut. There's activist groups that don't want to see it cut. Where do Congress members channel their inner Bert Lahr and find some courage?
Yeah, I'll tell you, I faced this firsthand the 2 years that I worked in the Justice Department. I was primarily working in the Office for Victims for Crime. And it's, you know, we were constantly dealing with members of Congress who had particular interests in the things that our office was doing. And so we had to pay particular attention to what they were doing, particularly if they happened to be influential members of Congress, chairman of committees or chairman of subcommittees, something of that nature. And so, yeah, it can be very tough to do that. But at a certain point, you reach the, okay, we really have to get something done here. Time in sort of the budget process, and hopefully, again, you get people in that mindset where you trim here, you trim there, you have less of that log rolling, you get rid of the earmarks, all these sorts of things, so that you get in that mindset where you are going to start making the hard decisions somewhere down the road before it becomes a crisis like it is in places like Greece and so forth.
Let's get in a call before we have to go to the break. Bob from Bettendorf, you are on the line. Welcome to the show.
Yes, mentioning Greece is apropos of my comment. A lot of the problems with job creation are state and local, and the federal government can have only minimal impact on that except by refusing to take, for example, Iowa taxpayer dollars to bail out California or Illinois and let the states which have foolish regulatory policies and tax policies, let them fail. And then let the business come to Iowa or Texas or whatever.
Thanks, Bob. We appreciate the call. Donna, all politics is local. Is all economy local as well? And is the president not that influential?
Well, I mean, the president can be influential. I mean, if you look at the stimulus, you know, package, being a professor at the University of Northern Iowa, we were directly affected by that particular federal piece of legislation that helped us in the economic crisis. So the president can be influential, but the caller is also correct in that job creation, a lot of it occurs at the state and local level as well, and there's got to be attention paid there, and these three, you know, local, state, and federal governments all have to work together, and that can be problematic as well.
And we'll have more on this after a quick break for IPR News. This is The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. We're speaking to Donna Hoffman and Tim Hagel. This is The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan All, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. We're talking about politics today. Donna Hoffman from the University of Northern Iowa and Tim Hagel from the University of Iowa are our guests. The State of the Union speech is our topic at the moment. What was your favorite part of the speech? What was your least favorite part? What did the president say that you liked? Was there something you wished the president had said? And how do you think Congress should react? You can call us at 866-780-9100. Send us a tweet at IPR Talk on Twitter. You can also send us an email at theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Let's go to the phones. Carl from Palo is on the line. Carl, welcome to the show.
Well, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was really inspired by the speech. He was he's an excellent speaker. There's no question about that. The only thing I don't like about the speech, and it's kind of hard for the president to do, is go after the military-industrial complex. That's where all our problem is. 80% of our debt is caused by the military spending.
Well, where do you get that number from, Carl?
Well, it's on the Internet. You know, it's all over the place. You know, they figure past spending for all the interest and the money for vet spending, you know, like for the health care and all that stuff for them, for years and years accumulation.
So, Carl, would you be in favor of the immediate withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq and Afghanistan in the interest of saving money?
Absolutely, and I would like to say the government shouldn't rob Social Security to pay for wars.
Carl, thank you very much for your call. We appreciate it. Tim and Donna, the president did outline cuts to some defense spending. Secretary Gates has obviously been out front on cutting things. The future of the Marines is at some level in jeopardy because amphibious assault, which is perceived to be their big job, isn't job one anymore in new kinds of warfare. Tim, do you think defense spending is really on the table for cuts?
Yes and no. Obviously, the Department of Defense is a huge bureaucracy, and anybody that's worked in a bureaucracy knows that there's always room for improvements, for improved efficiencies, to trim here, trim there, try to make make the dollars that you're spending go a little bit further. And certainly in an organization that large, you're going to have that ability to do so. The problem is when you start making cuts in important defense systems, whether it's missile systems or anti-missile systems or fighter planes or what have you, that then you start affecting our ability to defend ourselves. And I use defense there in a fairly broad sense, in that we have to project our power in various ways to help protect our allies in various locations around the world. And so, yes, defense is big. It's a big target. And certainly you hear the stories over the years going back, decades of, $700 toilet or hammer or whatever it happens to be. And you say, oh, come on, we've got to be able to fix that. And the answer to that is, yes, we do. But we have to make sure that we're not cutting it to the bone in a way that then puts our country in jeopardy.
Well, let's talk specifically about, even within the armed forces, there is such there's such parochialism.
What do you mean parochialism?
Well, in terms of if the factory in your area is supplying the part for this $500 billion program, as a member of Congress, you don't want to see that cut, regardless of the strategy implications. Whether the Marines are actually of a needed force, and whether their duties can't be divvied up among and efficiencies found between the Army and Navy and the Air Force. I mean, I can hear the people chanting Semper Fi right now opposing that. So even when you're talking about one part of the budget, it seems so split up that is there any way to realistically look at efficiencies that mean real cost savings?
Well, that's where somebody like the Secretary of Defense, Gates now, or whoever it happens to be later, that has to have a certain control over that. But the problem that you started right out with is that Congress, of course, controls this. And when you have influential members of Congress that make sure that the base in their jurisdiction or their district or their state is not going to get closed, then that's where you have some of these problems. In fact, there was a story not all that long ago, a week or two ago, and I think it might have had more to do with NASA, but it just exemplifies this problem where, because some member of Congress didn't want a base closed, that even though a particular program was going to be cut by NASA, we were still spending millions of dollars on it just so that the base would be able to bring in money to this particular person's home district. Well, that's ridiculous. But, you know, again, politicians being politicians, that's a separate problem than really what the, you know, money being spent in defense. That's a Congress problem. And so at least a number of years ago, they had the, try to remember the acronym, Base Realignment and Closing Act. And basically they had to get this independent commission to agree to this, and it was kind of an all up or down sort of thing, so you didn't have the individual members fighting over, well, we need to protect mine, we know we need to protect mine, and you get the log rolling going on. So I think that there are ways to solve the problem. They may not be easy, and certainly defense is going to be an area that could be cut to some extent, but on the other hand, that's not where the major problem is. Despite what the caller a few moments ago had said, entitlements are really where we're going to see a huge uptick in the amount of the debt and deficit spending that occurs, particularly as baby boomers start to retire, which is beginning to happen right now. And so as that upticks in health care costs, and even Obama mentioned this last night, that those costs need to be reined in. It's not defense that's driving the problem.
Donna, do you think that there is any kind of political will to change the strategy in the Middle East or change the defense budget? And considering that, on the one hand, that could play to Obama's base, but it also could alienate the people that he wants to find middle ground with?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the Tim was talking about the difficulty of doing this because of the nature of the programs you were mentioning about the parochialism in Congress. You know, this if we put together a package of spending cuts, you know, the people who tend to want cuts in defense don't want cuts in social welfare programs. This is something that can be in a big package. It doesn't necessarily have to be done by a commission, as the base closure was done. But it, I mean, it's a series of compromises that have to be done by Congress if we're going to meaningfully cut things. And if you want to cut mine, then you know you've got to be willing to have yours tinkered with a bit. And so for the defense spending, I do think it is on the table, and it is very difficult to cut. But it can be part of a larger package where the pain is spread around. As far as you know, changing the strategy in the Middle East, I think you mentioned, you know, I think that's a very volatile region, and we're even seeing things this week that, you know, things are, you know, with protests in Egypt and various things going on, there's a very volatile situation there. And so I don't, you know, really see a change in strategy to the extent that even we have a firm one there. It has always been relatively reactionary.
Let's go to the phones. Dick in Dubuque is on the line. Dick, welcome to the show.
Yeah, see, I was going to comment. I was a little disappointed in his talk that he didn't emphasize more hands-on type work, maybe CCC, WPA type programs, Depression era type programs. Even Sergeant Shriver just recently died, and even those types of programs where you give people hands-on works. I still think Obama, even though I did vote for him, he's a little bit too theoretical. He's, you know, more supportive of information manipulators, the accountants, lawyers, or Wall Street manipulators, than he is in tune with hands-on jobs. We got tremendous problems with water runoff in Iowa. There's a lot of work that could be done to prevent that. Everybody talks about the roads. Combination Depression, Job Corps-type programs, a hand up. Not a handout.
So, Dick, you'd rather see the government invest in that kind of program than in something where, like green energy, which may give fewer people jobs, but in theory would push the country in a different direction?
Well, it's possible they could build both. You know, maybe they could set up solar panels. You could have these WPA-type workers building solar panels in the desert or something. I'm not sure, you know, but it's a possibility that they could combine them both. As it is now, we're talking about importing solar panels from China, which is a shame, but that's, you know, the kind of the direction we're going in right now.
We also got an email. Oh, Dick, thank you very much for your call. We appreciate it. We also got an email from Mac in West Union who writes that we spend more on military than all other countries added together. More expenditures on the long-term health of the country may be of more value than short-term value in the maintenance of empire, in Mac's opinion. Mac also thinks Obama struck the right idea. Let's listen to a little bit of a couple of the Republican responses. And one of the things that was interesting is that there were two different Republican responses last night. They were essentially the same as far as content, but decidedly different in tone. We're going to listen to a little bit of each of them. The official Republican response was offered by Congressman Paul Ryan from Janesville, Wisconsin, who chairs the House Budget Committee.
Our debt is the product of acts by many presidents and many Congresses over many years. No one person or party is responsible for it. There's no doubt the president came into office facing a severe fiscal and economic situation. Unfortunately, instead of restoring the fundamentals of economic growth, he engaged in a stimulus spending spree that not only failed to deliver on its promise to create jobs, but also plunged us even deeper into debt.
And then the Tea Party recruited Representative Michelle Bachmann, a Republican from Stillwater, Minnesota, to respond to the president as well.
2 years ago, when Barack Obama became our president, unemployment was 7.8%, and our national debt stood at what seemed like a staggering $10.6 trillion. We wondered whether the president would cut spending, reduce the deficit, and implement real job-creating policies. Unfortunately, the president's strategy for recovery was to spend $1 trillion on a failed stimulus program fueled by borrowed money.
Now, both of these two clips are exactly the same in length, and they almost say the same things, but in much different style. Which one was more effective? Donna, what do you think?
Well, I think it depends on who the listener was, quite frankly. If you're a Tea Party sympathizer or you are affiliated with the Tea Party, I think, you know, Michelle Bachmann's tone was much more strident. I think that Representative Ryan tried to be a little less strident in his tone. And so, you know, we all filter, the public filters what they see, what they hear, oftentimes through their own partisan and ideological lens. So I think what you heard there, while if you analyze it, is similar, you're right to point out that the tone is very different. And so, you know, if you identify with the ideals of the Tea Party, Ryan probably wasn't strident enough, and Michelle Bachmann struck the right tone. If you're not affiliated or associated or don't like the ideas of the Tea Party, then, you know, you might have liked Representative Ryan's tone and the things that he said there a little bit more.
Tim, what's your take on it?
Well, I certainly wouldn't use the word strident. Usually that has a negative connotation, but I would go along with the idea that certainly Bachmann was a little more emotive in terms of giving the passion that she felt in this behind what she was saying, just sort of as giving a speech, since we've talked about how Obama is a good orator. I thought Ryan started off a little slow. He seemed maybe a little nervous that clearly he's been in Congress a long time. He's given lots of speeches, and he's a very engaging speaker. I've seen him on interviews. But I think the idea that he's talking to a camera in a room that was pretty much empty, that was a different experience. He just wasn't as used to it. But he seemed to warm up and sort of hit his stride about halfway through. Whereas with Representative Bachmann, that she, you know, was there. She knew what she was going to say, and she's taking a particular point of view. As you said, the substance really wasn't that much different, but she's hitting different, slightly different points and using different emphasis and sort of trying to say that, look, this is really a problem here. And so kind of trying to generate a bit more emotion, and that was probably more in her comfort zone. So she came off to me at least a little bit more relaxed in terms of being able to deliver the points that she wanted to deliver.
Which style do we think would resonate more with Republicans in Iowa? Because obviously at some level, these responses are looking towards the next presidential election. Michelle Bachmann was even in Iowa earlier in the last week, mm-hmm. and is kicking around the idea of running for president. So which of those tones do you think will resonate more with Republican caucus goers in Iowa?
Yeah. Well, here's where I will agree with Donna, in the sense that a lot of times different people want different things. And again, if you're a person that is more passionate about this particular issue and, you know, feel very that we have to do something right away, that you're probably going to feel that the Bachmann presentation was a little more appealing to you. And other folks that are saying, well, we need to take a more workmanlike approach to this, they're going to like the Ryan lines approach, and he's being seen as, especially given that he's the Budget Committee chairman, as the, you know, the serious person that is going to have to do the rolling up of the sleeves and you know, getting into the details of all of this, and that's what he's known for. So, you know, Republicans vary across the state of Iowa, and so you get a lot of folks that are emphasizing more the fiscal stuff, more the social conservative stuff, and so it's hard to say exactly who is going to be most appealing. To the extent that Bachman has been toying with the idea of, excuse me, a presidential run, or at least has said so, well, we'll have to see what happens. She's certainly coming back to Iowa in March for a homeschooling event, in April again for another event, and maybe even a few times in between. You know, not everybody that runs for president, and I'm putting little quotation marks around that, is really running for president. That maybe she's basically making a bit more of a national name for herself, either to set herself up for a Senate run or to become considered for presidential position down the road, or a cabinet spot or something of that nature.
Donna, which style of the response do you think will play better with Republicans in Iowa?
Well, it is hard to say, but, you know, things like the way that Michelle Bachman approached her speech last night, she was very passionate. And the caucuses in Iowa are all about turnout, and passion can inspire turnout. Talking about the budget and the hard things that we have to do in a very theoretical or very scholarly type tone might not excite people's passions in the state, Republicans. And so while there's a lot of variables here, and it's still quite early in terms of talking about who's going to turn out for the Iowa caucuses, I would note that there is kind of an interesting dynamic going on in the state, because if you looked at the Republican primaries in 2010, you know, the Tea Party favored candidates on the Republican tickets did not win the nominations in most respects. And so the Tea Party hasn't had just a huge presence here, but that was also the June primaries were also a little bit before some of that took off a little more nationally. You know, the Des Moines Register was reporting earlier this week that Sharon Angle was coming to the state. Now, I don't think that Sharon Angle's running for president, but she does appeal to a certain type of voter. And with Michelle Bachman coming to the state, I think there is a general feel in terms of the Tea Party organization, such as it is, because it's several different things, feeling out, you know, what is the climate in Iowa, what will resonate with Iowans, and I don't think there's a good answer to that yet, because we're not clear.
Is it a bad sign for the GOP that they had two responses, that they don't have one unified voice, or is it a good sign that there's so much discontent with the president that you really needed two addresses to completely encapsulate the entire discontentment with President Obama?
I would say that it's probably not the preferred thing for the Republican Party. It does illustrate a little bit the coalition nature of that party at the moment, with different factions coming to the fore. And, you know, it's Obama, you know, used the theme of we're an American family. Parties can be, you know, presented kind of in that way. And this is a big family, but not necessarily a big happy family, given what the Tea Party caucus in Congress wants to do, cut more than maybe even what more establishment Republicans want to do. And, you know, even some Republicans voiced some concern about the notion of having two responses. So it does, a little bit to the public, show that there are these fissures within the Republican Party potentially. And I think ideally the establishment party would have preferred to just have the one. But, you know, it does certainly speak to the passion that is out there behind the Tea Party movement, and gives them, you know, they feel like they have a voice in Michelle Bachman, I think.
Tim, do you think good, bad for the GOP to have two voices?
Yes. Which is to say that there are pros and cons to it. That, you know, I agree that certainly some people were trying to make hay out of the fact that, oh, this, you know, detracts from the Republican message and so on and so forth. And, yeah, okay, it does to a certain extent. But on the other hand, it does give a different perspective, and it lets people know that it's not same old, same old. In fact, that was part of the point of the Tea Party in the first place. It said a lot of the folks were getting tired with the establishment Republicans that were spending just as much, seemingly, as the Democrats. What would be nice, actually, and I heard somebody propose this, is to have, well, okay, how about somebody from the Progressive Caucus come out for the Democrats and give their take on what Obama said, or, you know, some other group, and we have a little bit more of this going on so that we get that different perspective. And so we see that there are different aspects to this and give people a little bit wider range of choice and knowledge as to what the members of Congress are thinking.
We do have a couple of more tweets and Facebook comments. We're not going to be able to get into them too much, but My Little Soapbox tweets, just how does being in two wars for almost a decade not contribute to driving our country further into debt? And a Facebook comment from Tony Sanders, I do not believe that the term Sputnik moment is appropriate. Under the president's administration, the space shuttle program and its replacement, the Orion project, were both scrapped. And, Tim, you had made that point earlier in it. If you want to continue the discussion, you can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter. We're at IPR Talk on Twitter. You can also find us on Facebook. That's all the time we have for today. Donna Hoffman at the University of Northern Iowa, thank you very much for being on the program today.
You're welcome.
And Tim Hagel from the University of Iowa, good to have you back as well.
Thanks. You're welcome.
The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Production assistance today from Brian Dow. Technical support from Dennis Reese in Iowa City, Russell Mansky in Ames, and Tony Daner in Cedar Falls. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Podcasting and on-demand audio of The Exchange is available at iowapublicradio.org. We always welcome your comments and questions about the program. Contact us anytime at theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Follow us on Twitter at IPR Talk. Become a fan of ours on Facebook at Iowa Public Radio. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Jonathan Aull filling in for Ben Kiefer today. Thanks for joining us.